you're in the House of Sounds, here to save the day, let's talk about your favorite movies, have some laughs and fun. Then when you're scared of deep, dark shadows, you won't need to run.
It's all horror fiction, still a screen addiction.
Spoilers! Spoilers! Warning!
Hello, horror fans! Welcome to Season 4, Episode 3 of Horror in the House of Salmons. I am Jamie, and with me is Brian.
Hey, what's up?
What? Are you trying to be cool?
I just wanted to do something different.
Okay.
Hello!
How are you?
I'm doing okay.
All right, well, I hope you guys have been doing well out there, and hopefully when this hits your feed, you'll be excited and listening, and, you know, we appreciate that. I guess if you're hearing me say that, you must be. So, thank you for that.
Just a second. Gee, I mean, look at this. Jesus.
Did Ophelia knock it down again? Yes, there she is in the same spot. She's so bad.
Like, get this thing out of my way.
So, Brody just came in here with a roll of paper towels that he proceeded to chew on that Ophelia has been knocking off the table for him.
I tell ya, kids.
Okay, well, on this episode, we're going to be talking about two... Brody! We're going to be talking about two films that have to do with the Wendigo legends.
Yay!
And then later on in Bumps, we'll be talking some more about the Wendigo legend.
Yay!
But for right now, it's time to catch up on correspondence.
Yay!
First, I'll start with there is a comment from Debbie Lynn on our most recent Patreon episode, which was Bone-Chilling Winter Horror Favorites. That's where Brian and I did a collective top 10 list of our favorite, actually it was 12, a list of our favorite winter horror films.
You do have a hard time with numbers,
Yeah. Debbie says, great list. Some honorable mentions for me would be Wind Chill, Evil Things, which is found footage, Penny Dreadful, and
nice.
Wendigo from 2001.
Nice.
How appropriate.
I need to watch Wind Chill again. I know I've seen it. I recognize the name. And whenever I see the poster, I'm like, yep, I've seen that. I don't remember a damn thing about it. So I don't know if that's a good thing or me just getting old. But I need to watch it again.
I don't know that I've ever... Who's it? What's it about?
I just said I don't remember anything about it, so I don't know.
Okay. I feel like I've seen it, but I really don't know, so we'll have to look into that. Okay, what have you got from the old Facebook?
Okay, from Facebook, we have Debbie again.
Yay, Debbie.
Replying to our post about the last show we did, about Last House on Left and You're Next. This would be our Second Chances episode.
Debbie says, just listened to it, and I really like the longer episodes. My favorite part was Jamie commenting on Demon Wind. Quote, eh, it's okay. I don't love it. I really don't even like it.
I don't get that. I mean, I do get that. It is not a quote-unquote good movie. But it's a fun one. It's silly.
I don't think it's fun. It's boring.
Ah. Here's a quarter. Go get some taste.
Okay. She said, I missed posting my top 10 of 23, so here it is, top to bottom. All right, so we're going to go bottom to top and go number 10, Dark Harvest.
Again.
Number 9.
God damn, I need to see that movie.
Appendage, which I've seen show up on several lists.
I've never heard of it.
Number 8, Resurrected.
Yay!
Number 7, Soft and Quiet. Number 6, Infinity Pool.
Nice.
Very nice. Number 5, Thanksgiving.
Yay!
Number 4, Godzilla Minus One.
God, I need to see that one too.
Number 3, When Evil Lurks.
Nice.
Number 2, Evil Dead Rise.
Nice.
And number 1 is Talk to Me.
Nice! Yay! That's a very good list. It is Brian approved.
Well, I'm sure that's going to keep her from being up at night now.
Oh, she can get a good night's rest now. And then we have Nicole replying to our bone-chilling winter horror Patreon show. And she says...
Nicole says, I'm so excited you guys are back. Oh, yeah, thanks.
We are too. Yeah.
And I love the new theme this year of giving movies a second chance.
Well, that won't be the total theme this year, but I do think we will come back to that again.
Yeah, it'll definitely come up again. And
I was really happy. Well, one part of our experiment didn't work all that well, but the second part, it proved that it's a much better movie than I originally gave it credit for. And I like that.
Oh, I do too. And yeah, it'll definitely come up again. But to be fair, we couldn't do an entire season of just that because I don't have that many.
Yeah.
That, I mean, and, you know, Brian makes fun of me all the time for being a mark, for being easy, but I...
And rightfully so.
I just tend to like things, you know, so... And to me, effort goes a long way. She's like, I'm all for the Dave Z second watch.
Yay.
Actually, I am too. I do believe in that. One movie recently that came up for me on a second watch was the Evil Dead remake.
Nice.
When I first watched it, I was not a fan. I didn't like the characters. There wasn't too much to the story, but I realized I was judging it too harshly because I love the original movie so much. So when the newest one was coming to the theater, I decided to rewatch it again, and I thought it was really good. Definitely top-notch gore and effects, and I liked some of the characters more.
I'm glad. I'm glad you gave it a second watch. I love The Evil Dead, the original. I mean, it is a landmark. It is an 800-pound gorilla. It deserves every accolade it ever got. But it's not a perfect movie. And I do think in some ways the remake was better than the original. Gasp! I know, that's heresy, but it did do some things better, and of course it did some things worse, and it's a different type of film. But that is an example where, much like Dawn of the Dead, I like the original and the remake both, even if they're not really tied together all that well, and, you know, it doesn't matter. I think both of them are good films in and of themselves.
I agree. Okay, she goes on to say, and since I do love lists,
yay,
I made a top 10 favorite winter horror films.
Nice.
So going from 10 to 1, number 10 is Frozen.
Nice.
I assume the Adam Green movie, not the Disney movie.
Oh, that's pretty scary.
Let it go. The Lodge.
Nice.
Number 8.
That is a movie I need to give a second watch to.
I should too. I really should too.
That is. There. Boom. Thanks to Nicole, I know what my second watch is because I called it first.
Oh,
suck it. But no, that is a movie that everybody seems to love. And when I first saw it, I thought it was okay, but I didn't get the whole it's so great and amazing thing.
No, but I do want to give it another shot.
So that will be mine.
All right. Then number 8, Pontypool.
Nice.
Excellent winter film.
That is one I really should have had on my list. I feel like such an idiot for forgetting about it. Because that is such a good movie.
It is. But, you know, we had a lot of...
Yeah, we already had 12 of them,
yeah.
So...
Plus some honorable mentions,
yeah.
So... Number 7, Dead Snow.
Yay!
Number 6, Misery.
Yay!
Number 5, Krampus.
Yay!
Number 4, 30 Days of Night.
Yay! Good on you!
Number 3...
A lot of people seem to give that movie shit.
Yeah, and I don't know why.
I'm guessing because Josh Hartnett's in it, and for some reason he's kind of a punching bag. Everybody seems to like to make fun of him.
I mean, he's gotten over his 7th grade haircut. Leave him alone.
But, no, that is a damn good movie, and
it
I'm
is.
Glad.
And it's one that I... really enjoy watching in the winter.
Yeah.
Number three excites me a lot, and that's Cold Prey.
Good!
And it excites me because we're the only ones I ever hear talk about that movie.
So, good on you for finding it, and good on you for liking it. Brody won't shut up.
Number two is The Shining.
Nice.
And number one is The Thing.
Well, I can't argue with that. That is a very strong, very good list. Well done. And thanks for sharing it.
Yes, always love that. I also went back, and these are a little bit older, but I did want to bring them up just so they don't...
Yeah, because we forgot about them until now.
But these are actually way back from November from the review we did of Thanksgiving for Patreon.
Okay.
Nicole says, it was so wonderful to hear your voices again. How sad that it was going to be so long before that happened again. I knew there
We're trying to be better.
I knew there was a good reason for the absence. Not that you guys have to explain, but I am so sorry for everything you guys have been going through.
Oh, thank you.
I wish I could give you both a big hug.
Oh.
I'd love that. And I hope things start getting better. Well, they have.
Yes, they have.
Thank you for the review of Thanksgiving. I want to watch this, and we'll get to it soon. I'm always up for a good slasher. And like you said, Eli Roth is definitely a huge horror fan. Maybe we will get an unrated cut when it comes to DVD. I get that studios probably want to hold back to get more people to see the movie, but us hardcore fans deserve more sometimes.
And you know, that's a good question, if I can interrupt.
Yes.
I know Thanksgiving is out on Blu-ray now. I still haven't picked it up, but I will. I wonder if they have an unrated cut.
I don't know. I haven't seen, but I hope they do.
But part of me says they probably don't, because Blu-rays nowadays, unless they're coming from one of the boutique dealers like Scream Factory or Arrow or something like that, they're so bare bones. They're such afterthoughts. Everybody, and by that I mean the studios, are so high on streaming that physical media is fucking all but ignored anymore.
Well,
from the major studios.
Yeah, they don't care about physical media anymore. And that actually came up the other day at work because I was talking about how we watched, you know, My Bloody Valentine. And my boss, who is also a horror fan, he was like...
Yeah, he's a good guy.
He's like, where did you get that? He's like, do you just have all of these movies at your house?
Yes.
And I'm like...
Yes, we do.
Yes. And he's like, really? And I'm like, yeah.
We're kind of sick that way.
And I'm like, I will never stop collecting physical media. And he's like, well, you're probably going to have to eventually. And
never.
I'm like, don't bring that up. Because I don't ever want to think about the day when they no longer make it.
Yeah. And they probably will. But I hope I'm... Hey, hush. Brody says hi. He just wants to play.
Nicole goes on to say what you will about the Terrifier movies, but I love how they don't hold anything back.
True.
And I do have to say, I really enjoyed Terrifier 2, the gore. That one kill in the bedroom that just went on and on and on and was so mean-spirited.
I liked Terrifier 1. That movie seems to be getting a lot of shit nowadays.
Yeah, which is weird because people were very...
Yeah. I mean, it's nothing great. It is a very low budget, and so it's... You know, a couple people sitting in a warehouse and blood. So, I get it. But for what it does and what it is, I think it does it well. And it was a fun movie. My only problem with Terrifier 2, it's way too fucking long.
Yeah. And there's...
It is stupid long.
And it didn't need to be.
No.
If it needed to be, that's a different story.
Exactly.
But
I don't mind a long movie, but when I say something is stupid long...
Shh, Brody.
That means it does not... have any need to be that long.
Yeah.
It was just director, usually self-indulgence.
If I can, while watching a film, point out chunks that don't need to be there, that do nothing for the story, but take up time, then, you know, I feel like it could have used another pass. But I still enjoyed it.
I did really like it, and I would love to see a fan edit of it, where they take out, I don't know, 45 minutes?
Yeah.
Easily?
And she says, and you have to respect Damien Leone for wanting to stay independent.
No, that's
to
cool.
Keep the control in his own hands. Yes. And I do respect that quite a bit. Not that there aren't good studio horror movies, but no. They tend to cater to general audiences, hoping to get the casual or even non-horror fan in seats, which leaves the rest of us wanting more. So I'm still excited to see this movie. It sounds gorier than most mainstream movies.
That's why both my number one horror movie of the year for last year and the year before were both studio films that I thought they did an excellent job with. And that would be, in case you forgot or don't know, Smile and Talk to Me.
Talk to Me was A24, so...
But that is a studio film.
No, I know. I'm saying that... It doesn't surprise me that they would go there. I mean, no, you know, look at, like, Midsommar. They didn't hold back.
No. Everybody bitches about the Hollywood studio system, and for good reason. I totally get that. But if they want to, if they have the desire, they can still make excellent movies. So just like I would never condemn a movie for being independent, low budget, I'm not going to condemn a movie for being studio just because, I don't know, that's the hipster thing to do.
Yeah, no, I actually love it when studio mainstream horror films do well, and not just when they make a lot of money like Ouija, but when they do well and deserve it.
Yes.
So, like, when It came out.
Yeah.
You know, I was really happy, you know, when Paranormal Activity first hit and it was massive. I was really happy for that. I want the mainstream audience to accept horror.
Oh, yeah.
And, you know, stop trying to push it into the shadows.
The more people that like horror, the more horror movies we get.
Exactly. And the more that we want, we get. I mean, we get more of what we want, not just what they're willing to feed us. When they see that good movies make good money, then they're more inclined to make more like that. Like Smile, for instance.
Yeah.
It did so well that they created an entire horror branch of
I don't know if they've done anything yet, but that was something that was happening.
Yeah, so they're sitting up and taking notice, and
they're
seeing good.
All the buckets that Blumhouse is raking in. And you can say what you want, and believe me, I have. Not everything they touch is gold. But everything they touch makes fucking money. I don't think they've lost money on a movie yet. Well, maybe The Exorcist one.
Oh, God.
Because, fuck that movie.
That makes me sad.
But,
then we have a comment also from David Garrett.
Yay, hey, David.
He says, man, sorry to hear everything you're going through. Made me tear up.
Aww.
And I just know you both through listening. Aww.
Well, thank you.
I know from my point of view, take the time you need, and I'll be ready when you drop stuff. Well, I hope you were ready, because we're dropping stuff.
Here you go.
And thank you so much for the support.
Yeah, thanks.
And that's what I was saying when I said before that you guys have been incredible and supportive. You have, and I do really appreciate that, because we needed that last year.
Yeah.
But, you know, things are looking up, and so far,
this is a much better year.
Excited to be back.
Yeah, I've been having fun with it again.
Me too.
So
it has reinvigorated my love of the game.
Essentially, I'll keep doing it as long as I keep having fun with it.
Yeah, and that's what it's all about.
Yeah.
Okay, well, I guess that's going to be it for correspondence for this episode, and we may as well just take a quick break and then come back to the movies.
We hope you're hungry for some good movies.
Because here they come.
And now for our feature presentation.
Okay, we are back, and it's time to talk about our movie choices. This was my choice, the topic. But interestingly, you know, when the way we do it, whoever chooses the topic, the other person picks first.
Usually.
So I found it interesting that you chose what you did for this topic.
Oh, yeah, I guess. I always like to try to think outside the box. And technically, my pick is not a movie, but I have never cared about that. And if people don't like it, tough.
All right. Well, first...
But yours is a movie.
Yes, it is. So first, we're going to talk about my choice, and that was Ravenous from 1999, directed by Antonia Bird. It stars Guy Pearce, Robert Carlyle, Jeffrey Jones, David Arquette. Is that it for the big ones?
For the, like, biggest big ones, sure.
Oh, it also has John Spencer. It's a relatively small cast. So the idea here, and we just recently talked about this on our Patreon show for our winter horror films, but we'll go a little bit more in depth here. But this is...
Well, real quick, because I don't know, are we going to talk about it in the intro, what our subject is? Or
yeah.
Okay.
This is a story about the Wendigo, you know.
Yay.
Like, you know, what a surprise. it also has to do with cannibalism, which most Wendigo stories do.
It's like his big main motif.
Yeah, but I happen to think that this...
Not every Wendigo story or story with the Wendigo is about cannibalism. One that comes to mind readily for me is Pet Sematary.
Yeah.
Now, I've always wondered, why did King include the Wendigo in there? I can only assume because it was about Native Americans, and that's probably the most infamous Native American boogeyman kind of thing. Because that really doesn't feel like a Wendigo story.
Well, it doesn't even come up in the movie. Very briefly. Actually, they don't even mention the word. You just hear it in the distance.
That is one neat thing about the recent remake, which I do think is pretty horrible. But I think in there...
I like it.
Yeah. I think in there they actually... And I could be wrong. I've only seen that movie once, and that was enough. But I think there is a glimpse, a scene or two of something in the background that could be the Wendigo.
Ah. Well, I remember that I actually saw the Pet Sematary film before I read the book. And I was very excited to read the book to find out what that was screeching in the woods at them.
Mm.
And I was very disappointed to discover that he didn't really talk about that.
No.
I mean, it's mentioned.
It's a name drop, but that's about it. Yeah.
And so but it has no bearing on the story. So, yeah, I never got why he included it at all, but...
But that is an example of a Wendigo story without cannibalism.
Yeah.
However, other than that, it's pretty rare. He is the northern spirit, a spirit of hunger. That's like his main thing. That's like a vampire story without blood sucking.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sure they could exist, but why?
Well, you could have spiritual vampires.
Yeah, yeah. And that's actually been done.
Or what's his name in What We Do in the Shadows, the show?
Yeah.
The social or whatever he's called.
Carrion Comfort by Dan Simmons. That's about a whole novel about psychic vampires.
Hmm.
And it was pretty good.
All right.
So that's a vampire novel with, I don't think, any blood sucking.
What else did Dan Simmons write? I know that name.
Most recently and most notably, probably he did The Terror. Which was later turned into
the show.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
Dan Simmons is
based
great.
On the real life.
Yeah.
The Terror ship.
In Erebus, which is where we get that from. But yeah, I like Dan Simmons. He's a hell of a writer. I wish he had more notoriety, success, etc.
Mm. Anyway, back to the film. This movie is, I think, is loosely based on or inspired by the story of Alfred Packer. And when people think of people traveling west through the Sierra Nevadas and, you know, cannibalism, you think of immediately the Donner Party. But Alfred Packer was a different situation that took place years after the Donner Party And
it was a Donner dinner party.
It was kind of more insidious than even the Donner party. Anyway, but in here, we start off with Guy Pearce, who was a soldier in the U.S. Army during the Mexican-American War. And there is one particular battle that his side is losing quite handily. And he gets spooked and decides he's just going to lay down in the dirt and pretend to be dead. But that even goes on to the point where when the enemy starts piling up the bodies,
he happens to be on the bottom of the pile.
He's on the bottom of the pile and he still plays dead.
Captain, they kind of do that exact thing in Hostel, don't they?
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. I think it's something that's used quite a bit.
It's horrible having all your friends dead on top of you.
Doesn't she do it in Cold Prey too? Or am I thinking of something else? I don't know. He has his dead sergeant leaking, or captain, leaking blood into his mouth. And suddenly, he's not quite as afraid anymore. So he ends up climbing out from under those bodies and taking the entire camp by himself.
He basically captures the general. And if he put a gun to the general's head, he tells everybody else, okay, everybody, surrender. So that's how he's able to do that.
So he's commended for that.
Yeah.
And he gets a medal for bravery and a promotion. However, they know how he did it.
Well, because he was honest.
Well, he was. And they know that he was a coward.
Yeah.
So they ship him off to this fort that is in the Sierra Nevadas up in California.
It's a little nothing of a fort.
Yeah, it started out as a Spanish mission.
Yeah.
And then now it's a fort, and there's nothing going on out there. But it's wintertime.
It's got a little teeny wall around it, a handful of buildings, and it's manned in total by like a half dozen people.
Yeah. I mean, they just run a skeleton crew because it's wintertime, and people aren't crossing the Sierra Nevadas during the winter.
Nobody with common sense.
If they planned it correctly.
Yeah.
Which a lot of people didn't. And so that's kind of why it's important for them to even be out there. So at this fort, we have Jeffrey Jones, who is the leader, and they also have Toppler, who is their cleric. Not cleric.
Someone's been playing too much D&D.
He's their
holy man.
Yeah. And then Cleves, who is played by David Arquette. He is he's on peyote and weed all the time.
I mean, they're all soldiers, that should be said, so they're all there for military reasons, but they perform certain functions. And yeah, Toffler, he is like the holy guy, so he runs the local chapel or whatever, and he's trying to keep spirits up. David Arquette, he's kind of just like the gopher. He's the one they always tell to go get the supplies, go do this, go do that, fix the wall, etc. So he's like a handyman more than anything else, but I'm sure he's a soldier too.
They also have Knox, who is, he used to be a veterinarian, so he counts as their doctor, but he's also drunk. So Jeffrey Jones advises Guy Pearce to not get sick.
Yeah.
And then they have a couple of local Native Americans that they just kind of inherited along with the fort.
Jeffrey Jones is the base commander, and Elephant in the Room, yeah, he's a scummy child porn collector guy that basically got busted for having child porn, so his career is over. Which is a shame, because I always liked him.
I know. I never saw him turn in a bad performance. And he's done some weird shit, you know, like Howard the Duck.
Yeah.
But he was always fantastic. And I love him. You could always count on him showing up in period pieces.
Yep.
And he was great for that. And I loved him for it. And it breaks my heart to this day that he fucked himself.
Yeah.
You know, but
Then there's, what the hell? Reich.
Oh, yes.
Reich's probably my favorite. He's like the gung-ho soldier. In fact, Jeffrey Jones tells Guy Pearce, oh, but you know, there's Toffler and he's this and there's this guy and this guy. And then there's Reich. he's our soldier.
Steer clear of him.
Yeah.
He's you know,
he is
dedicated.
So over the top. He is so ready to kill something.
And I can't remember that guy's name, but he's gone on to be kind of big.
Oh,
but,
yeah.
You know, he does a lot of shit.
Yeah, he's been in a ton of stuff. He was in Band of Brothers. He was great in that. He was in Justified. He was great in that. A lot of TV work. Oh, but he was also in, what the hell was that? Minority Report.
Oh,
Tom
yeah.
Tom Cruise.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. So, yeah, the guy's busy.
So this is a great cast.
Yes.
I love the cast. So one night he's out there, he's getting himself settled in, and, you know, they're just kind of chilling out in the snow, and someone comes to the fort, and he sees him out the window, and then they see him collapse, so they go outside, and they drag him in, and that is Robert Carlyle. And he explains that he was crossing with a guide called yeah. Colonel Ives.
He's a preacher. He has the collar, he has the crucifix, and, you know, he was part of this wagon train heading west, led by a military man, Colonel Ives, who supposedly he knew of a secret shortcut that could, you know, save months off their trip.
Yeah. See Alfred Packer.
Yes.
That's what, but he tells them that, you know, they got stranded. They ate all the oxen. They ate all the horses. They ate all their shoes.
They ate all the belts.
They ate roots. They ate everything they could. And it got to the point where they were huddled in a cave and starving. And Colonel Ives, well, one guy died.
One guy died of natural causes like the weather or getting sick. And when this guy, Calhoun, is telling his story, he was like, I was out looking for food, and when I came back, I could smell meat cooking.
Yeah, they were cooking his legs for dinner.
Yeah.
And he's like, you know, God help me, I smelled the meat, and I couldn't help it, I ate. And they all did. But it only lasted a few days.
Well, one person amongst, like, seven or whatever, that's not a lot.
Well, there were
and as also
six,
as hungry as they were.
There were six total, according
okay.
to Calhoun.
Yes.
He was one of six, which means there should have been
five yeah.
left after that man died. And then, according to him, Colonel Ives just lost his shit
yep.
and started killing everyone and eating everyone until there was one woman remaining whom her husband had already been killed, and Calhoun escaped. And
because he figured with just the woman and Ives, he's probably the next to go.
Right. And so he's like, I know I should have stayed to protect her, and I would have, but I'm not strong enough, and, you know, blah, blah, blah. So he tells them the whole story, and they go to this cave. He
Which
takes
is like
them.
A number of days away in the mountains.
Yeah.
So it's not an easy journey.
Well, and they're suspicious. Like,
yeah.
how long have you been out there? And, you know, total. And also, how long did it take you to
yeah.
get here? In the snow, with no food.
I guess you could call it a miracle.
Yeah, I guess you could. So he takes them all, except for Knox, to this cave to show them what's going on. But when they get to the cave, they discover that things aren't exactly the way he told them they were.
Yeah, he has a little bit of a secret. And then once you know it, people start dying horribly.
Now, it is a 25-year-old movie, so
I guess spoilers.
I guess it doesn't really matter, but
Calhoun is Ives.
Yeah.
He's the guy who purposely led the wagon train into the mountains, got them stranded, so he could eat them all. And he did.
But there were six bodies in the cave.
Either he flunked his numbers, or there was a Colonel Ives.
That's
that
what I
he
think.
Now usurped his.
Yeah. Well, I always thought for years, you know, every time I watched the movie, I just assumed that he was really Colonel Ives because he does show up later.
Yes,
as
Colonel Ives.
And I was like, you know, but this time when this was the first time I actually caught it and then allowed myself to think about it and try to figure it out. But when Reich goes into the cave and he discovers all the skeletons of all the dead people, I love that scene, by the way. You know, he's just like, la, 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 going in the cave, looking around, trying to find this woman, trying to find Colonel Ives, and all he sees are dead bodies.
Yeah.
And he counts them, and he's like, shit! And then he starts running back out, screaming it's a trap. But at that point, it's too late.
And Calhoun slash Ives slash whoever the hell he is, he goes bonkers. And I love his crazy, insane... murder.
Oh, yeah. It's like right up there with Brad Pitt and 12 Monkeys. Yeah. His little crazy hand signals and, you know.
He goes all Terminator on a couple guys right in at the start. And then he tells the last guy in front of him, around him, who's still alive, run.
Yeah.
And then he starts chasing him for fun. Hooting and hollering and having a good time.
His performance is...
yeah.
Just fantastic.
I like everyone here. Again, even Jeffrey Jones. I know I should hate the guy because he's a nasty piece of work. But as an actor, I always enjoy him. And he's a good guy here.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, out of all the people at this fort, he seems, his character anyways, seems like he has the most stuff together. He's smart. He knows multiple languages. He enjoys reading old books in their original languages. He seems to care about his men. He seems to care about other people. He's the first person, you know, when Calhoun comes in and tells him the story, he's like, okay, we gotta go and save her. And they're like, what? Why? And he's like, that's our job. That's what we do. That's why we're here. We gotta go save her.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, he's a good dude, but it doesn't save him.
No, but then we get a nice little surprise later on that I won't spoil, but even then, he's a good guy. And Robert Carlyle is, it's kind of weird because you can tell by, you know, the fact that there was blood dripping in Guy Pearce's mouth at the beginning that, you know, and then he jumped up and took the enemy.
Felt some of the power of the Wendigo.
But he has not given in to it.
No, the idea behind this is if you're caught starving or close to death or whatever, in Native American myth, you would hear the Wendigo call to you. And if you answered, if you replied, basically the Wendigo would give you an offer. Let me in and I'll save you. And if you do, sure enough, he will, but then you will always have this insatiable hunger. Essentially, yes, it's like a vampire mythology. It's like the Native American version of that. You will always be hungry for flesh.
But it will heal you.
Yes.
It will make you strong. It will pretty much make you invincible.
Yeah.
Unless you get like a headshot or something.
They can be killed, but it takes a lot of punishment to kill him.
Yeah. And Robert Carlyle, though, he doesn't care. Like, he has no qualms at all about eating people. He actually sets it up.
Having a death sentence will do that for you. He was someone with tuberculosis.
Tuberculosis, yeah.
And at that time, that was instant. No, sadly, not instant. It was inescapable death, but it took a long time. You coughed blood, you wasted away. It was a horrible way to go.
Yeah, but I mean, he's gotten just evil about it.
Well, yeah, because he's, again, like many mythological stories, it's now like an addiction. He craves, because not only does eating people physically heal him and keep him healthy, it also gives him power. But the power never stays.
Mm-hmm.
So that's why has super strength. That's why he can take a bullet and get back up. But it ebbs and flows. And when it starts to ebb, you gotta eat somebody to top it back off. So it's constant. You're never satisfied. That's the thing about the Wendigo. That's like the one main part of his mythology. He's never satisfied.
I like it when Martha, she's one of the natives that's there. I like that how she describes it.
Yeah.
You know, and she's like, the Wendigo always takes, never gives.
Yeah.
And that is true. I also, though, I think it's really sad because she knows that, Guy Pearce, she knows that he is
tainted by the Wendigo.
And she actually thinks, I believe, that he's the one killing everyone. And in the end, when she
comes
across
because she's very suspicious, and she even pulls a knife on him at one time.
At the end, when she comes across them together, she just kind of turns around and walks away. But
well, because she thought he would give in and become the Wendigo, and because that's what everybody does. Nobody can stop this. Once you start down the path of becoming a Wendigo, you will become a Wendigo. But Guy Pearce, to his credit, he fights it tooth and nail all along. And at the very end, he sacrifices himself. He gives himself to stop this.
So, well, and she tells him there is no, there's no cure. You have to die. But I just think it's sad that he dies with her thinking that he was responsible for killing Cleves, you know.
I don't know if she knows about that. At least how I read it, I think the final scene of her, you know, seeing that, she kind of knows what was going on because there's no other excuse for that. Because Guy Pearce is always like, no, Ives is the Wendigo. And then she was like, no, I can tell you're the Wendigo. But when she finds them both dead at the very end, I think she's like, oh, okay, well, he managed to stop becoming the Wendigo by sacrificing himself, and he obviously wanted to kill this guy at the same time. Maybe he was right.
Yeah, so they use this impossibly large trap that I don't know what the fuck you would be capturing.
It's
with
not
it.
Even a bear trap.
No,
it's a hippo
about
trap. Or
eight
something.
Times larger than a bear trap. Like, I don't know what that's for.
Dinosaurs.
And then in the end, she's just like, fuck it, I'm out.
And she just walks away.
But now that we've spoiled the shit out of that for you, really, there's a lot more stuff. We didn't talk about everything. There's some really cool other twists and turns in there.
Because it's filmed in Northern California, or at least something standing in for it, at winter. Nobody asked you.
Look at that look.
I know. Don't you mock me. The cinematography is top notch. This is a good looking film.
Oh, and the score. It's one of my all time favorite
the
scores.
The score
is amazing.
I always think of it as akin to Texas Chainsaw Massacre. It's more musical than just that, because that is literally just sounds and creepy sound effects. But it's very, I don't know, avant-garde or something. It sounds strange. It sounds weird. It sounds like it should not be good. But with everything going on in this, and just how everything in the movie itself is so weird and bizarre, I think it fits it. Because this movie, it is 100% a horror movie, but is also heavily laden with black comedy.
Yes. Yeah.
The blackest
but that's
of comedy.
That, to me, is what sells it.
Yes.
Is what makes it so good, because it's extremely well written.
But it's with that little bit of off-kilterness that the sound effect really, it enhances. It goes hand in hand. And if you've ever heard score, you will always remember it. You will instantly recognize it. It has been used in like a bunch of commercials and stuff over the years since. And it's really impressive. Combined with the awesome acting and the very good direction, this movie is just a winner throughout.
Oh, yeah. Highly, highly rated. Highly recommended. It's one of those that I can watch anytime. I never get tired of it. It's just so good.
Now, on just a personal level, it's a little bit supernatural light. The only supernatural elements you get here is the toughness, the hard to killness. Because Boyd has a broken leg, and then after he succumbs to some Wendigo goodness and has a bowl of stew, his leg heals up really quickly, and so there is some supernatural element to this, but it's very light. I would like a bit more of the spookiness, the otherness.
I don't know, I think it gives it a grounded quality.
It does, but it's not supposed to be grounded. It is a supernatural story. It is eat people and live strong and, you know, whoop ass and all that stuff. But that's just a minor thing.
Anyway, well, do you recommend it?
Highly.
Well, unfortunately, Ravenous is not streaming anywhere. I mean, you can rent it on Prime, Apple, YouTube, Vudu, you know, or you can buy
all
it.
All the places.
But, yeah, we had to watch our copy of it because couldn't find it anywhere.
I would recommend the Blu-ray. It's from Scream Factory. They did a damn good job with it, but they always do.
Yeah. Okay, well, that's, I guess, it for my pick. Go out and see it, guys, if you haven't. If you have, let me know what you think. But for now, let's move on to our next selection.
Yeah, I could see people with Ravenous, because it is such a strange and different kind of movie. I could see some people not liking it.
Yeah, I guess.
But I highly recommend giving it a shot.
I would question their taste.
Yeah.
I'm just kidding. All right, Brian, what did you pick and why?
Okay, a little bit of history real quick. My pick originally comes from, well, it began on Showtime with a series they were running. They did for 2 seasons. It was called Masters of Horror. I highly recommend it. Like all anthology horror TV shows, it's not 100% perfect. Not every episode's a winner, but more of them are than not.
Mm-hmm.
Unfortunately, it was very expensive to do, so Showtime canceled it.
Well, these were all, for anyone who may not be familiar, these were all directed by
bigwigs,
like
the masters of
huge
horror.
Huge guys, you know.
John Carpenter did two movies.
Dario Argento.
Toby Hooper had one in there. Takashi Miike had one in there, and so on and so forth. Yeah, a lot of famous horror directors at this time made like an hour long movie for this series. And like I said, it was really good and a lot of fun, but it got canceled. However, the guy who head things up, the guy who had the idea behind it, Mick Garris, he managed to take the show to, I forget what network, one of the networks.
I think it was
NBC,
I could
ABC.
Be wrong, but I want to say it was NBC. I might be making that up, but I think that was right.
And it was basically the exact same show that had famous directors come on and do these little mini movies. They changed the name and called it Fear Itself.
Which I always thought was clever.
It was.
You know, there's nothing to fear but fear itself. And this right here is Fear Itself, so fear it.
And I love the intro.
Oh, I do too.
But,
And you know what's funny is I haven't watched these since it aired.
Oh, okay.
And as soon as the music started, I immediately knew it. I mean, I just was, you know, like along with it. And yeah, I love the intro for that. I used to love the one for Masters of Horror,
too. Oh,
yeah.
They're both good. They're probably both done by the same guy.
Yeah. Now, it was during a time that if you paid attention, you would notice a lot of shows had the same style of intro. That was really common back then, but this, I think, was one of the earlier ones to do that, and it was...
Yeah, it was... This series was in 2008, so...
Yeah.
Anyways, this series sadly only got one season, and then that was the end of it. I wish they would bring it back. There was some talk, Mick Garris, of course, everybody has a podcast now, haha, but... He has a podcast, and it's really good.
That's Postmortem, isn't it?
Yes.
Okay.
And he was talking on one of the episodes, I don't know how long ago, but, maybe there is some talk of doing a Master of Horror again, but I don't think anything ever came from it.
You know what's sad about that, though, is we've lost several of our masters.
Yeah.
And
but we have new ones.
We do. And that's what I was going to say, is that would be a great opportunity to bring in someone like Mike Flanagan or, you know, one of the newer ones or some of the newer ones, the next generation, and let them flex a little bit.
So that's what I picked for my Wendigo pick. There are other Wendigo movies out there, and some of them are very good, but I always like this one. In and of itself as a short little movie. I like that it's done. It was directed by Larry Fessenden.
Yeah.
Who we were just talking about last time.
Yeah, we were. And we also mentioned the fact that he loves Wendigos.
Yes.
Like, that's his thing. He has a movie called Wendigo.
He's played with the Wendigo mythology, I think, twice.
Well, this would be the third one.
So.
And Until Dawn.
And then, yeah, then he wrote the video game Until Dawn, which, spoiler, also deals with the Wendigo. So, yeah, he is definitely a Wendigo kind of guy. But then again, so am I. Mm-hmm. I love the Wendigo. I love the idea behind it. And I really like how it's used here.
Oh, this is honestly, I think, the best episode of the series.
Easily. I know, I'm not sure about Masters of Horror, but of Fear Itself.
Fear Itself, I mean, yeah.
It's my favorite of them.
Doug Jones.
Well, yeah, Doug Jones, for those who don't know, he is the tall, skinny actor who plays all the monsters. Because he is so skinny and so tall, he can fit the monster suits really well.
Mm-hmm. He works with Guillermo del Toro a lot.
A lot. And he is a really good costume actor. He has the movements down, he has the little tics, and he includes that in all his roles. But here, we get to see him be a human as well.
Mm-hmm.
While,
and do some dramatic acting.
Yeah, while there are some special effects on him that come and go, he also gets to play a normal guy at times as well. So that was neat for him. Anyways, as for the story, Doug Jones is a rancher. He has a wife. He has two kids, both boys, both in their teens. And he has his younger brother, who also lives with them on the ranch and helps out as like a ranch hand. And there's also another ranch hand who, of course, just happens to be Native American. If you're gonna do a Wendigo story, you gotta have them there to give you the exposition. Anyways, we start with them right in the middle of, oh shit, Dad's missing. And Dad's been missing for like a week.
Along with two other guys.
Yes. Yeah. Him and three other, I don't know if they're fellow ranchers or just fellow ranch hands, but they went into the woods to do something, and they never came home. So they're all gearing up. We're going back out to look for him. Oh, but it's, you know, there's a storm coming. Well, what are you going to do? We can't leave him out there. And then right in the middle of all that, he comes walking back in. Now, because you got Doug Jones, he's skinny as hell. But he wasn't always that way. They actually show a picture of Doug Jones, like in fat makeup or in a fat suit, looking like an average, well-built, maybe even kind of chubby guy before he went missing. And then now he's been missing for so long, he's, well, this
Skin
episode is called Skin and Bones, and that's what he is. But yeah, he comes out walking back out of the woods, not happy, not in a good way. He's stumbling and barely moving. His fingertips are all black with frostbite. His, like, lips are pulled back in a grimace. He's in a bad way. But they bring him home. They put him in bed. They wrap him up. They call a doctor, and the doctor's like, yeah, well, he's still alive. And he's obviously malnourished, but it's amazing he, you know, lived as long as he did out there without any food. So just keep an eye on him. Feed him. He's definitely going to be hungry, but he should be okay. And so they're like, yay, we got Daddy home. But of course, it's never that easy. And as you could guess, since we're talking about Wendigo stories, he has become a Wendigo. And I always like that aspect about the Wendigo mythology. There is the Wendigo, which is the spirit of the cold and the hunger and the, you know, all that. But he can also make you a Wendigo. And where, again, if you give in to temptation, if you give in to cannibalism, if you essentially kill somebody to eat them, you know, you're purposely trying to kill them for your own benefit and nothing else. That is a very selfish thing. So he is always a very selfish deity, entity, whatever. But yeah, he can spawn others, and that's what this guy is now. And I like that you can get a bit of a look of what a Wendigo could be. Because yeah, he is so tall and thin Then they use makeup to enhance that and exaggerate it. I love that he goes through moments of back and forth where sometimes he's the husband, the father, and he's like, you know, sick in bed, and he's like, I don't know what happened. I just, it was cold, and I was hungry, and I think something's bad. And, you know, he's trying to warn his family. He's trying to be a good guy. And then other times, I love the evil of the Wendigo coming out, because you can hear the Wendigo talking through the guy. I mean, he knows stuff that he shouldn't know, and he's taunting the people around him just to be a dick.
Mm-hmm.
And so I like that aspect. It's a bit more than just, oh, I ate people, now I gotta keep eating people. It's more of an evil, demonic entity kind of thing.
I like the fact that he talks about how he heard something whispering in his ear.
Well, yeah, again, if anyone's going to know the mythology, it's going to be Larry Fessenden.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it's very much a traditional Wendigo story. Probably the most traditional Wendigo story Fessenden ever did. And I think he just nailed it. I think everybody does a good job here. Doug Jones is great. He's a good actor just acting, you know, like a person. But when he starts going into Wendigo mode and he's, you know, flicking his fingers and he has his lips all pulled back to show that skeletal grin and he's all like, here's a carrot and an onion. Put them in the pot.
Yeah. Oh my God, that is so funny.
I'm hungry.
You feel like, honestly, when it gets to that point in the episode, I'm kind of like, does it need to keep going? It doesn't need to keep going. Because we had a pretty definitive, what could have been a definitive ending prior to that. If they wanted to end it.
Yeah.
But then it, you know, it keeps going. But then I'm like, well, it's not really necessary, but it actually gives us some of our best moments with Doug Jones.
And it also gives us some more of the horror.
It does. I'm just saying, story-wise, it didn't have to be there. But I'm glad it is, because he's so good.
Mm-hmm.
And his, you know, frostbitten, blackened fingertips, when he wiggles them, they look like claws. And
well, that's why I was saying about his movements and all that. Like, one of his more famous roles, for all you Buffy the Vampire Slayer fans out there, and hey, I'm one of you.
Me too.
Probably one of the best episodes in Buffy was called Hush. It was actually a silent episode, and that's the one with the gentleman.
Mm-hmm.
And those are those awesome-looking skeletal, so because they're skeletal, you know, Doug Jones is going to be in there, but they're very withered and pale and skeletal. They have metal teeth, they float around, and he's always doing these things with their fingers. Like, I remember some interview I saw with, he was like, Joss Whedon, who much like
Jeffrey Jones.
He's kind of an asshole, but
differently. I hope.
He's not as far as I know, he's not a child not predator or something. Pizza. But yeah.
Sorry, we don't have to do that.
No,
we're not YouTubers.
Yeah, we can say adult words. But anyways, he told him when he was playing that part for the Buffy show, I want you to do the Nosferatu hands. And he knew exactly what he meant, and he would start doing that. And just, he does that here too, and it looks creepy as fuck.
Oh,
maybe because he has long, thin fingers, and I'm sure they probably use makeup to extend it even more. And like, he looks so gaunt, gaunter than usual. Again, makeup, they make his eyes look sunk in, and again, those lips are pulled back.
And his cheeks are protruding. But that's the thing about, it's like when they had to get actors for later seasons of The Walking Dead, when the zombies...
To be the zombies,
They had to keep getting actors that were skinnier and skinnier and skinnier to make it believable. I actually met one of them when I did the tour, and he's like, I've played like six different zombies because I'm one of the skinniest guys there is. And he was super skinny. And so, yeah, you know, his Doug Jones' physique, I mean, not only is his acting ability, his physical acting, perfect for a role like this. But he also has that naturally skinny physique that, you know, was easy for them to just kind of build up and make it look super gaunt.
You mentioned Del Toro before. Doug Jones was the Fawn from Pan's Labyrinth. Mm-hmm. He was also the amazing Pale Man, also from Pan's Labyrinth. So he played two different critters in there. He was Abe Sapien from Hellboy. So yeah, if you've watched any Del Toro movie, I believe he was the Fish Man from
Shape of Water.
Shape of Water, yeah. So yeah, you've seen him. So he knows how to move his body. He knows how to be creepy as all hell. And it's done here really, really well. So you have the awesome physicality of Doug Jones. You have Larry Fessenden overseeing all the Wendigo stuff, and he definitely loves his Wendigo. And it's just, it's a really good story.
Plus, I think, didn't K&B do all the effects for these shows?
They were doing them for the Masters of Horror, and they just kept doing them for Fear itself.
So that right there is top-notch. And you don't get any better than that.
No. And it is a network television show, so unlike Masters of Horror, there's not going to be any boobies. There's not going to be any swearing. There is some blood, but not tons of it.
I actually don't feel like there's anything missing.
No.
From the, I mean, it's done so well that it's not like I watch Masters of Horror and then I watch this and I'm like, well, this sucks, you know?
No.
But a lot of people thought so at the time. Like, well, they were unhappy with the fact that it went, you know, from cable to network.
I get that. I get that initially.
That's why it died.
Yeah. I get that initially because it does, okay, this is a horror series, and by definition, it's going to be weaker or softer than what it was before. But for me, I've said it before 100 times, I'll say it 100 times more, anthologies, be they TV shows, movies, or books, they live and die by the story. That's why I wasn't a real good big fan of the recent Twilight Zones. I wasn't a real big fan of the previous Twilight Zone iteration. I think they were too focused on guest stars of the week. Whereas the original Twilight Zones had some of the best writers working at the time for that show.
Big writers, too.
Richard fucking Matheson. He wrote like a third of them.
And Robert Block.
Yeah, I mean, just these are serious writers. They know how to tell a good story. But Hollywood has this idea in their head that I guess writers don't matter. And so as long as you put some recognizable faces in it, that's all people care about. Hoo hoo hoo. Not me. Give me a good story over anything else, any day of the week. And this is a good story. It's not all that, like, oh my god, mind-blowing. Especially if you know the mythology of the Wendigo. Like I said, it's very faithful. So it very much follows, this is what happens when you become a Wendigo kind of thing. But I don't care. I like that story, and I like how it's told here. I like everybody's acting in it. I like the look of the Wendigo. I like the sound of the Wendigo. The Wendigo, I mean, there's like 2 or 3 times where it's just having a hissy fit. And it sounds creepy as fuck. This is one of my favorite Wendigo experiences in cinema.
Oh, absolutely. I would say, movie-wise, Ravenous is my favorite, just because I love that movie.
Oh, that's a great movie.
But honestly, as far as just specifically Wendigo, I think this is the best version I've ever seen.
Yeah.
I really do. It's, and it doesn't surprise me, just like it didn't surprise me to find out who was behind it the first time I watched it, because that's what he does. So I love it. And I, like I said, I think it's the best episode in the series. And if you want to know about Wendigos, then this is a good place to go.
Now, sadly, it might be hard to find. Well, no, not really hard to find, but if you want to own it, that might be a bit tough. They do have it on a DVD collection. They never put it on Blu-ray, sadly. The DVD collection is pretty neat because it looks like a little tombstone. That's what we have and all that. Short of that, it's practically gone. I don't think it's streaming anywhere.
It's on YouTube.
But it is on YouTube because it's been largely abandoned. Mm-hmm. So they can put it on there and keep it on there without whoever owning the rights having too much of a hissy fit. So if you've never seen this episode and it sounds like something you would like to see, and you should, yeah, check it out on YouTube. It's Fear Itself, Skin and Bones.
Yep. If you search Fear Itself, Skin and Bones full episode, the first one that comes up should be perfect. Anything else you want to say?
I was just going to ask you that.
Oh. No, I think we pretty much covered it.
Again, it's a short movie. It's, you know, it was an hour long with commercials, so it's probably 45 minutes. But I'm a big fan of that, you know. How many times do I rail against movies not needing to be 2 hours, 2.5 hours, 3 hours? I mean, you don't need to be that self-indulgent. In, out, done. You can tell a story, you can tell it well, and you don't have to waste a lot of time. Skin and Bones, Fear Itself. I say check it out.
Definitely. Okay, well, we're going to take a quick break, and then we'll come back with
some more Wendigo goodness.
Yeah. All right, we are back, and it's time for Bumps in the Night. And, do you know, I don't think, actually, I know, we didn't tell them what we're doing this year as far as Bumps in the Night and ABCs.
Oh.
Not ABCs, collection.
Oh, why don't you tell them then?
Well, this season, we've decided that we're going to alternate. So, 1 week, we'll do the collection. The next episode, we will do
a bumps
in the night. Now, there may be occasion when a particular topic calls for a bumps in the night, when it's not, you know, it's
yeah
turn.
That's not a hard and set rule,
but we were just trying to come up with ways to make,
if you hear someone whining in the background, that's Brody. He's upset right now.
Yeah.
But anyways, go ahead.
We were trying to find ways to make the editing process a little bit easier and faster for me, so I wouldn't just get bogged down with 8 hours of editing work to do and burn myself out. So we've decided that we didn't want to get rid of either of those segments because we enjoy doing them, but we figured it would be...
And according to some of our listeners, you like them.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, everybody seems to have their favorites.
Yeah.
You know, so we don't want to get rid of anything, but we will alternate them so we get the best of both worlds.
Yay.
For this episode, we will be discussing the Wendigo.
Ooh.
Which we kind of mentioned earlier, and it should be obvious anyway.
But here's your reminder.
That's what it's all about. Just in case you forgot from a few minutes ago.
And I will be jumping in every so often with some Wendigo facts.
Oh, this is going to be fun.
Yep.
All right. Well, the Wendigo is attributed to the Algonquins as a legend from Algonquin folklore. And, of course, and like we discussed when we were watching the movies, it is an
Wendigo fact.
Okay.
My middle school was Algonquin.
Ah.
Ooh. So I have some of the Wendigo running through me. No, not really, but I just like that.
Well, it's an evil spirit that is said to possess humans and causes them to have a feeling of insatiable hunger, along with a desire to eat other humans and the propensity to commit murder. In some representations, it's described as a giant humanoid with a heart of ice whose approach is signaled by a foul stench or sudden unseasonable chill. Well, that could just be you coming in the room.
Well, yeah. You got the foul stench covered.
Now, this is something I thought, don't be a This is something I thought was interesting, and I didn't know it was a thing.
What's that?
Is Wendigo psychosis.
Oh,
and
yes!
That is a modern psychiatric disorder, which seems to be a culture-bound syndrome, and that's interesting too. So in some First Nations communities, they will also throw in things like insatiable greed and destruction of the environment as symptoms of the psychosis. But people with the Wendigo psychosis, symptoms include intense craving for human flesh and fear of becoming a cannibal.
Well, I mean, that's... I can see where that would be appropriately named, and also why it would be a cultural thing, because, you know, for the Native Americans, I don't know about now anymore, but, I mean, they grew up, and it's their legend, and it's been around forever, so... In fact, Wendigo fact! That's not going to get old ever.
No, I love it. Keep going.
What largely introduced the Wendigo to Westerners, i.e. white European type people, was a story called, well, it was actually a novella, called The Wendigo. It was by Algernon Blackwood, who was a famous English novelist. He was a broadcaster. He was like an early, almost like radio personality. So he did a lot of things, and he also wrote a ton of ghost stories, horror stories, and whatnot. And they were really good. And he wrote The Wendigo all the way back in 1910. And it's basically about two guys in northern Canada looking for folk tales and legends and stuff. Naturally, they have a Native American like guide to not only guide them through the forests and wilds, but also to impart exposition when they need it. And people go missing. There is the Wendigo. And I won't say too much about it because it is a really good short story. I've read it at least twice over. I really like it. It doesn't have any of the cannibalism aspects, at least I don't think it does, or they're mentioned in brief, but it is the spirit of the North, the cold. I think hunger is mentioned, but it's more of just like winter personified and how it can take on. And it has a neat thing about footprints that I'll just give a hint about. But I won't say anything more about. So, yeah, the Wendigo has been amongst us, lovers of weird and horrific fiction, well, since 1910. In fact, H.P. Lovecraft even mentioned the story. I will have you read this little quote because, although I love reading, I hate reading out loud.
Okay. So,
take it away, baby.
Another amazingly potent, though less artistically finished tale than Blackwood's The Willows, is The Wendigo, where we are confronted by horrible evidences of a vast forest demon about which Northwood's lumber men whisper at evening. The manner in which certain footprints tell certain unbelievable things is really a marked triumph in craftsmanship.
Yes, Lovecraft really did talk that way. And, you know, good on them for mentioning, or good on him for mentioning the footprints again. And in fact, Lovecraft really liked the Wendigo story. That might come up later in another Wendigo fact!
Oh, well, for now, I'm going to talk about one of the more famous cases of Wendigo psychosis.
Nice.
Now, this was involving a Plains Cree trapper from Alberta named Swift Runner. During the winter of 1878, Swift Runner and his family were starving, and his eldest son died 25 miles away from emergency food supplies at Hudson's Bay, at a Hudson's Bay Company post. Swift Runner butchered and ate his wife and five remaining children. Given that he resorted to cannibalism so near to food supplies, and that he killed and consumed the remains of all those present, it was revealed that Swift Runner's was not a case of pure cannibalism as a last resort to avoid starvation, but rather of a man with Wendigo psychosis. He eventually confessed and was executed by authorities at Fort Saskatchewan.
He just felt like eating some people.
Yeah, there was another well-known case of Wendigo psychosis involving Jack Fiddler. He was an Oji Cree chief and medicine man, known for his powers at defeating Wendigos. In some cases, he entailed killing people with Wendigo psychosis. And that's another thing, too, is they would often execute people to prevent them from cannibalizing, other people. Fiddler and his brother were arrested by Canadian authorities for homicide in 1907. Jack committed suicide, but Joseph was tried and sentenced to life in prison. He ultimately was granted a pardon, but died 3 days later in jail before receiving the news of this pardon.
Wow. I like how it goes hand in hand with the original tales of if you hear the Wendigo calling your name, and if you let it in or answer it or anything like acknowledge it, you're going to start killing and eating people.
Mm-hmm. Really very frightening, not only to face up against someone that is possessed by the Wendigo, but the thought of being possessed yourself.
Yes.
Because like we've said numerous times, I really don't think there's anything more frightening than not being able to control your own actions.
Hey, look at the time.
What's it time for?
It's time for another Wendigo fact.
By the way, I had no idea he was going to do this. But I love it.
So I mentioned how Lovecraft loved the Blackwood story and how it's been around since at least 1910. And it was one of the first and biggest of what you would call the weird tales. Which, once again, as the broadest definition, what Lovecraft did was write weird fiction. But more specifically, what he's more known for now is the Cthulhu mythos. And that is all his tales about the undying, unknowable, ageless evil gods like Cthulhu, but also like Yog-Sothoth, Azathoth, and a whole bunch of other hard-to-pronounce guys. They were such a hit amongst his very small circle of friends. I mean, sadly, Lovecraft never got really much fame out of his work until long after his death. But anyways, one thing about Lovecraft I always loved was he was very open with all his toys. He didn't really come down on, oh, you can't use that. No, he liked when other authors used his building blocks to incorporate into their stories, to build their own stories, to make up their own crazy, unknowable evil gods, and all that stuff. Well, back in 1933, there was an author named August Derleth. He will become very important to the Cthulhu mythos. In fact, he's the one who coined the name for these collection of weird stories as the Cthulhu mythos. Lovecraft never really named it, or if he did so in jest. He called his, what you would call the Cthulhu mythos, his name for it was Yog-Sothery, and that was him being a witty, funny guy. Anyways, Derleth wrote a short story called
The Thing That Walked on the Wind.
Very good. And yeah, he introduced a new take on the Wendigo as the great old one, Ithaqua. Ithaqua is known as the Windwalker, or the Wendigo, and again, just like the previous Wendigo story from Blackwood, it's not so much on the cannibalism. Now, naturally, the Cthulhu mythos is a living, breathing thing. It grows, it continues, even today. I mean, hell, that's how I make a living, is by making books about the Cthulhu mythos. In fact, I've even wrote my own short story about Ithaqua and the Wendigo. It's a little piece of work called Feast of Famine. If you ever get a chance, check it out and let me know what you think of it. Regardless, though, here is an example of somebody taking work from somebody else that comes directly from the Native Americans and now incorporating it into the Cthulhu mythos, where it would grow and grow. In fact, it grew so much that
some years back now, I think like 20 years back now or whatever, Chaosium, who does the awesome Call of Cthulhu role-playing game in which Ithaqua is present, they started releasing some fiction books, and one of them was The Ithaqua Cycle. And that was a collection of about a dozen or so short stories all about Ithaqua and the Wendigo. So, if you like the Wendigo, and you're looking for another take on him, a more cosmic horror take, or you just are interested in that stuff already, check out The Ithaqua Cycle from Chaosium. And brush up on your Ithaqua-ness. And because of his link to the Cthulhu mythos, like I said, he has appeared in the Call of Cthulhu role-playing game. He's appeared in video games. He's appeared in card games, in board games. And, well, yes, lots of movies, too. But yeah, so Ithaqua / the Wendigo is very much alive and well.
Well, and speaking of Ithaqua, do you know the significance of that as far as future writers?
I don't know where you're going with this, but go ahead and take me there.
That is the character that directly inspired Stephen King's portrayal of Wendigo in Pet Sematary.
Oh, was it Ithaqua?
Yes.
I did not know that. And it makes sense because, I mean, again, there's no real cannibal link to that version of the baddie. So maybe that's why. Yeah, that makes sense. I could see that. That's cool.
Also, because of that story, there was a Marvel character.
Well, that was going to be another Wendigo fact.
Oh, well, hit us with it.
Well, no, go ahead.
No, no, no.
No. I do not want to step on your toes.
I insist.
Well, okay, only because you made me so. Yes, there is a Wendigo comic book villain. It appeared for the first time in 1973. Hey, that's when I first appeared, too.
Uh-oh.
See?
Were you
another Wendigo link?
Were you in The Incredible Hulk number 16?
No.
Okay.
But yeah, he first appeared in The Incredible Hulk, and because he's an Incredible Hulk villain, he has to be a big bruiser, because that's what The Incredible Hulk does. He fights other big bruisers. And so the Wendigo in Marvel Comics is a big, huge, white, kind of like Sasquatch, a Bigfoot kind of guy. The interesting thing is they do keep some of the original mythology alive, because the Wendigo in the comics isn't just one guy. It's not like one super villain got turned into the Wendigo or, you know, some science experiment gone wrong. It's actually an evil spirit, and it possessed a guy. And when that first Wendigo finally died, another person became the Wendigo. So I like that. It's kind of like the real Native American horror mythology of it, just in comic book form. And fighting the Hulk, because that's what you do.
Well, there was also, now this one I never played because it was a kind of a disaster and it was online only. I was just a mess. But in Fallout 76, Bethesda used a Wendigo character.
Yes. I've heard that too. I have not played Fallout 76, so I'm not 100% sure about all the details, but I'm not surprised. All of the Bethesda boys are, well, I don't know about all, but the people who write the games and make the games, they are huge Lovecraft fans. And that's why in pretty much all of the Bethesda titles, you can see multiple Lovecraft references and Cthulhu Mythos references and so on and so forth. That's a topic for another day, but yeah, I could see where their love of weird fiction and cosmic horror would have them do something like that.
Yeah, I just love how prominent it has become. Of course, we recently had the Guillermo del Toro produced Antlers.
Yes.
That came out, and there is a 2021 film with a Wendigo, which I have never seen, and we need to rectify that, called The Inhuman.
Never even heard of it.
Nope.
Yeah, we'll definitely check it out.
Oh, speaking of movies, are you ready for another Wendigo fact?
Always.
This isn't really a Wendigo fact. It is a false fact.
You're a liar.
Yeah, I know. I went looking for what was the first movie to have the Wendigo in it. And Google lied to me. Now, somebody wrote this article, so this is what Google's quoting from, but they're wrong. According to this, the first movie to have the Wendigo in it is from 1951. It's The Thing from Another World.
That's not a Wendigo.
You know, the movie that would later be remade by John Carpenter as The Thing? No, that is not a Wendigo movie. I mean, the only thing I can think of is because it's a horror movie set in the cold.
But that, don't be stupid. It was an alien.
It was an alien. It was a vegetable alien. It was basically a killer carrot in a movie. The story, it was very much like what Carpenter did. So, I mean, that holds true to that end. But no, that's not a Wendigo story either. So, yeah, this was kind of a bummer, because it's just blatant misinformation.
Aww.
It's also one of the things where, in some of the Wendigo stories that has come out, I don't know about the original mythology, but I'm talking about other somewhat famous horror stories featuring the Wendigo. He has a certain limit, like, he is stuck to the northern hemisphere. Naturally, because he's a creature of the winds and the cold, and that's where all Native Americans would identify cold coming from. They had no idea that Antarctica was a thing way down south. So, if you want to get all hoity-toity and put your nerd glasses on, he is technically impossible from being the Wendigo. But yeah, he just wasn't anyways. He was a alien carrot from outer space who liked to drink blood. I know. Anyways, I just wanted to point that out, that if you go looking for the first Wendigo movie, the computer's gonna lie to you.
Hmm. Well, there was an Ojibwe teacher and scholar from Ontario, Canada, called Basil Johnston, who, he has a description of the Wendigo. And he says, "The Wendigo was gaunt to the point of emaciation, its desiccated skin pulled tautly over its bones, with its bones pushing out against its skin, its complexion the ash gray of death, and its eyes pushed back deep into their sockets. The Wendigo looked like a gaunt skeleton recently disinterred from the grave. What lips it had were tattered and bloody. Its body was unclean and suffering from suppuration of the flesh, giving off a strange and eerie odor of decay and decomposition, of death and corruption."
That is my favorite description of the Wendigo. That is my favorite preferred version of the Wendigo. Nowadays, Wendigos always have antlers. And they're very much animalistic. And that makes sense to a certain degree because, again, Native American, wilderness, northern. So I get all that. But I like the emaciated, gaunt, usually very big, just weathered. And it really imparts the hunger aspect.
Right.
I mean, essentially, like I said before, it's like the Native American version of the vampire. It's always hungry. It can never get enough. It could eat 100 people in one setting, and then it would get up and go, "I'm hungry." So it's never satisfied. And a depiction like that really sells that.
Yeah, by the way, for those who don't know, suppuration, because I was thinking people might think I said separation of the flesh.
Oh.
No, I said suppuration, which is the formation of pus.
Yeah.
So he was, and yeah, that kind of makes sense. I guess you could have gotten that from context clues, even if you did mishear me, because, you know, it said that it caused a stench of decay and decomposition. Yeah. So basically, it's like a giant infection, which smells awful.
You know what I would call that?
What?
A pus fact.
Oh. Well, I'm sure everybody wants to have plenty of those.
You never know when a pus fact can be helpful. You're at a party, people are talking about pus and infections and weeping sores.
Yeah, and then you just pull out the word separation.
Yeah, you look like a million bucks. Mm-hmm. But I do have a short little itty bitty Wendigo fact for you. Do you know we have a Wendigo State Park in Michigan?
Oh, I didn't know it was in Michigan. Yes. I knew there was a Wendigo State Park, but I didn't know it was in Michigan.
It is a small little island between Michigan and Canada, and you can really tell because it's officially called Isle Royale National Park. Now, with a name like
Does it have cheese?
With a name like that, I would naturally think it would be Canadian, but no, it is American, and more specifically, it's in Michigan.
Well, we should go there.
We should definitely go there. I've always wanted to, but my lazy sit-around-do-nothing self has always been like, I'll do it later. But yeah,
well,
that
now
would...
I'm here, and I make us do things.
Baby gets things done. But yeah, it's not spelled the same, but it is a Wendigo State Park.
Well, a lot of people spell Wendigo with an I.
Yeah.
I've noticed that when I was doing research, that it kind of bounces back and forth between W-E and W-I, so...
I personally like the W-E, but hey, too. Whatever.
Okay, well, I will follow that up with a little bit more about Wendigo psychosis, which I'm just fascinated with, because I didn't know that was a thing, but that's so fascinating.
It's like the Native American version of lycanthropy, the mental disorder.
Yeah. So apparently the psychosis occurs in people living around the Great Lakes of Canada and the United States. So you better look out. Wendigo psychosis usually develops in the winter in individuals isolated by heavy snow for long periods. The initial symptoms are poor appetite, nausea, and vomiting. Subsequently, the individual develops a delusion of being transformed into a Wendigo monster. People who have Wendigo psychosis increasingly see others around them as being edible. At the same time, they have an exaggerated fear of becoming cannibals. I guess that's because they feel it in them. You know, and they're like, it's going to happen.
And just like Ravenous, once you give in to it, you can never come back.
I also think it makes sense that it's often, or I guess most of the time, if not all the time, connected to the cold. Because that would be the times when food is more scarce, when hunting is more difficult, when people are traveling and they get stuck, you know, like Alfred Packer.
Well, yeah, that's...
Or the Donner Party.
If it's summer or spring or even fall, there's going to be food around. There's going to be animals to kill and eat.
And vegetation.
You're going to grow crops and whatever. But yeah, winter has always been the season of... hunger. And this is just the personification of that.
Well, I also think it makes sense that the legends predominantly take place in the northern part of the country and up into Canada, because in the south, you didn't have that much of a earth of food in the wintertime. Now, there was snow
winter,
in the south, but it's not at all like
it is like
up
you
here.
Always like to point out. It does snow in Georgia, damn it!
And, well, it snows everywhere at some point, but it's not.
But
like
there's
it
a
is
big difference
in the north. Yeah.
Winter in Georgia, let's say, than winter in Saskatchewan or something.
Or even something like North Dakota, where...
Or Michigan.
Yeah, where you have to drive around with whiskey and blankets in the trunk of your car just in case you get stuck somewhere. So I love finding the origins of legends. Now, this I already knew, the origin of this legend, but... And then just making them make sense. And I think that this makes a lot of sense. Because if people would turn... to cannibalism out of desperation, then you don't want to admit that someone that you care about has the propensity to do something like that.
Yeah.
So what do? You come up with a reason, and the reason must be that they were possessed.
Yeah. It's easier to believe in evil as an outside force than just evil that it's something that lives inside of all of us.
Yeah, just ask a question.
Yeah, exactly.
I'm kidding.
Not really. Or it's just, it's desperation. What will you do to survive? I mean, cannibalism in pretty much all cultures is a taboo. Now, of course, there are some real cannibal, like headhunter kind of people. Fine. They gain power from eating their enemies and all that. But for the most part, it's always looked down upon. Killing somebody in battle is one thing. Killing somebody, then carving them up, then eating them and passing them around, that's something else. That is, and it's also, there's a primal terror in humans about being eaten.
Right.
We like to think we are at the top of the food chain and, you know, we can just kill and eat anything and nothing eats us. No, you're wrong. Now, in a modern world, yeah, you don't have to worry too much about a saber-toothed tiger coming up and eating you or anything like that. But just go out in the woods. I mean, hell, look what happened to Grizzly Man.
Yeah.
He lived with the bears and they were his buddies and they were his family until one got hungry and then ate him. And I think his girlfriend, too. It is so frightening. It is something that has just stayed with us in our bones, in our DNA, from time when we were out in the woods, living by a little campfire, afraid of the dark.
Well, yeah. I actually wrote an essay years ago about, you know, what we fear. And I was trying to boil it down to find out, you know, what it is that drives us to love the feeling of being afraid, like from watching horror films and things like that. And so what I tried to do was boil it down to the most basic thing that all humans have a fear of. And it's obviously, you know, the more encompassing one is death. But really, it's not death so much itself. To some people it is, but for the majority of us, I think it's how. And to think of yourself being cannibalized is a horrible thought. I mean, that's why things like Texas Chainsaw Massacre work so well to tap into those fears. These people aren't just killing people. They're killing them and then eating them. Or so we assume, because it's actually never outright said in the original Texas Chainsaw.
Yeah.
But even take something like The Road.
Yeah.
It is
the feel-good movie of the year.
Right. It's a post-apocalyptic film with a man and his son trying to travel to get somewhere safe. But along the way, we run into horrifying things. And it's always the most horrifying thing is cannibalism. You know, there you see a baby being turned on a spit. That's horrifying. But even in things like zombie movies,
everybody knows you bake babies. You don't spit roast them.
No, they don't know what they're
You're
doing.
You're just wasting it.
But even in zombie movies, they'll throw in, you know, a cannibal clan.
Well, for that one, it's always they have become the enemy. I mean, technically, they are still alive. But just like the zombies, you're nothing but food for them. That's all they see you
and
as.
And that adds a layer of horror to it. And I am a sucker for cannibal movies, cannibal stories, cannibal anything.
Like cannibal cookouts?
I just, there's something primal about it that really just gets to me. Or in like a film like We Are What We Are.
Yeah.
You know, the disease Kuru. I've always been drawn to and fascinated by those things. And I think it's because it's probably one of the most horrible things I can think of that another human can do to another human. Now, I don't blame people who are caught in a situation
like alive.
When
you gotta do what you gotta do.
They didn't kill anyone to eat them.
Well,
they just ate.
You don't know if they killed anyone to eat them.
I don't think they did. They just ate their dead. To me, I don't think there's a problem with that. Now, it's not good for you. Like, eventually, if you eat
it's like
people,
mad cow disease,
exactly,
but for people.
But for people. So you, it's not something that you should do. But in a situation like that, I can understand that, and I wouldn't blame them for it.
No, like I said, you do what you got to do to survive. If you get a taste for it, and you keep wanting to indulge even after you're survive, you know, even after you're safe and back in civilization and all that stuff, then you have problems.
Right.
But, you know, if you gotta eat somebody to live, yeah, hopefully they're already dead. And you're not killing anyone to do it.
Yeah. Do you think you could turn cannibal in a dire situation like that?
Yeah.
So do I.
I mean, not even, I'm gonna live. I'm gonna do what I have to do. I'd like to think I wouldn't be out there murdering people to
yeah,
do that.
Yeah, I have no desire to kill anyone and eat them, but
if a body, if someone's dead, then a body is just a body. Whatever made them them is long gone, so now all you got is a big hunk of meat. Why not eat it?
Yeah, I totally agree. And honestly, if I died first and you had to eat me to stay alive, I'd want you to.
Aww.
Well, because why should you die because I did when you have nourishment right there?
Now, you know, I'm going to keep this recording as evidence.
Yeah.
So, you know, a couple years down the line.
Just in case you get busted for spending all your time on Cannibal Cafe.
Yeah.
Now, of course, we do have modern day stories of cannibalism, like Army Hammer.
Yeah.
Now, not that
maybe
he is
has Wendigo psychosis.
Not that he is.
Maybe
a cannibal,
it's not his fault
that he had, you know, fantasies of cannibalism. Although there's that whole story about him staying out in that there's like a ranch or a old motel or something out in the middle of the desert where he stays and people go missing.
Yeah.
No, I don't think he's a cannibal.
He does come from a long line of strange and not too nice motherfuckers.
Well, that's true. He does
the
have...
The Hammer family are bastards of the first degree.
Yeah. And very rich.
Oh, yeah.
But they got
bastards usually get rich.
Yeah. All right. So that's pretty much all I have to say. What... Do we have anything else from you?
Just a real quick Wendigo fact.
I wish you guys could see him every time it does that. It's so cute.
And it
gets all his whole body into it.
And it's really not a Wendigo fact, but it is a suggestion. If you like Wendigos and the mythology behind it and would like to read more about it, there is always one book that I have loved for many a year. It is done by an author named T. Chris Martindale. And he was a guy who wrote a few horror novels back in the day, but only a very few. Then the guy just disappeared, and I don't know what happened to him. Now, I don't think he, like, literally disappeared, although he might have, but he just stopped writing or whatever. And I loved his books. He wrote a haunted house book that I forget the name of right now. He wrote an excellent vampire book called Night Blood, which has one of the best setups ever. It's Rambo versus Salem's Lot.
Huh.
And that's exactly what it is. A Vietnam vet who can see dead people comes home to a small little town that just so happens to be, you know, ground zero of a vampire invasion, and he whoops some ass. So it's really cool. You get Barlow being all pissed off at fucking Rambo and shit, and those two going at it. But he also wrote a book called Where the Chill Waits. And that is one of my favorite Wendigo novels of all time. I highly recommend it. But again, because this guy, yeah, kind of vanished, and his books never got too much press when, even when he was making them, a lot of people don't know about it. So, if you ever get a chance, or if you just got the hunger for more Wendigo goodness, go on eBay or something. You could probably find a paperback there cheap. I think it would be a good investment.
Well, I guess the only thing left is to ask you guys, have you seen the movies we talked about? If so, what do you think? And do you have any favorite Wendigo stories or films or even video games, because Until Dawn is fucking great.
That's a bit of a spoiler, but yeah. Yeah, that is a really good game. And there are a couple movies that I still haven't seen. I just now found one called Dark Was the Night from 2014.
I feel like I know that title.
I've never heard of it.
There's also one from 2022 that I found called The Wendigo. Now, did we actually watch that one? I want to say we might have watched that one and it wasn't very Wendigo-y, but
yeah,
I might be wrong.
That's like the movie called Cthulhu that really has nothing to do with Cthulhu. It happens. So yeah, if you've seen Dark Was the Night, what did you think about it? If you've seen other Wendigo-type movies that we haven't talked about, mention them. If they're new, I'll definitely, or not new, but new to me, I'll definitely check them out. I've always got a hunger for that kind of entertainment.
Okay, well, they probably have a hunger for less puns, so...
You're so tasty.
Oh my God, do I need to get worried? And now, the only thing left to do is to thank everyone for spending time with us and listening to the show.
Thank you, everyone, for spending time with us and for listening to our show.
Aw.
No, thanks, everyone. As always, we had a blast. We hope you did, too. And we hope you come back for more.
Oh, there is one more thing.
What's that? Okay, well, I guess it's my choice. And I think I'm going to go with an idea I had previously, but then shit fell apart. We never got to it. I guess we're going to do it now. It's an author spotlight, as it is, but in regards to movies, and when you're talking about authors and movies, there is one name above all else, Stephen motherfucking King. So, I am once again going to break the rules because I'm a rebel. And
we're busting loose.
And I am going to pick not a movie to talk about, but a miniseries. And the reason I want to do this miniseries is because it's still winter here by the time of us recording this. And this miniseries is very much all about winter. I think I brought it up in our winter horror episode.
We both did.
For patrons. Mm-hmm. So, yeah. It's been a while since I've seen Storm of the Century.
All right. Well, you know what it's been a while since I've seen?
What's that?
Needful Things.
Nice. Yeah, it's been a while. Yeah. Yeah.
So, that's going to be my pick.
Oh, very good.
Well, I guess that's it, guys. You got your homework for the next episode. I hope you enjoyed our Tales of the Wendigo.
You mean the Wendigi? Yes, I know I'm mispronouncing it. I'm making a point.
Oh, that was the line.
Yeah.
Yeah, okay. Yeah. I remember that now. Well, that movie always makes me call it now Wendigo, because that's how Martha pronounces it.
Oh, yeah, well.
And I figure she's Native American, so she probably knows.
I would hope so. But...
All right. That's enough, guys. We will see you next time. Love you loads. Bye.
Bye-bye.
Thank you for visiting the House of Salmons. We hope to see you back very soon. Until then, come chat with Brian and me on our Facebook group page at Horror in the House of Salmons. And if you like what we do here and want to hear some bonus episodes, consider being a patron at patreon.com/houseofsalmons. Special thanks to Rick Morgan for composing our theme music.